Hello, this is Elton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. First, as usual, on our reading of the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the biz page, on which we find several short articles, and today's no exception. And under the heading of philanthropy is the article, Gala Pivots to a New Approach. Most, if not all, live galas have been canceled by groups around the Triangle this year. While it becomes difficult, especially for nonprofits, to raise money, organizations are getting creative. For example, First Tee of the Triangle is holding a virtual gala October 21st, complete with viewing parties at private homes, live auctions, and a chat with some well-known golfers and sports personalities with North Carolina roots. This year, the group has convinced Jay Bilas, the former Duke University basketball standout and current ESPN analyst, to virtually speak and moderate a session with three PGA golf professionals: 2014 U.S. Open champion Webb Simpson, Triangle residents Chesson Hadley, and Carl Patterson. It will be interesting to see just how much money the First Tee will raise from its virtual gala. And under the heading of technology comes the article, Innovate Raleigh Goes Virtual and Attracts Some Major Names. The Innovate Raleigh Summit is going virtual, and it includes strong guests. Jumping into the conversation, we've a lineup that includes Red Hat co-founder Bob Young, CapTrust CEO Fielding Miller, Pink Ceiling CEO Cindy Eckert, Pendo CEO Todd Olson, Kaleido co-founder Sophia Lopez, and Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce CEO Adrian Cole. The two-day summit stretches over November 5th and 6th. And under the heading of commercial real estate, the article, Parking, a Key Component as New Triangle Projects Rise. Two high-rise projects in Raleigh took different paths when it comes to a critical part of construction, parking. The One Glenwood and Two Glenwood projects developed by Heritage Properties decided on a separate deck. The Fallon Company took a different approach at its Raleigh Crossing Tower, putting the offices above multiple levels of parking. Managing Director Zach Van Cannon of the Fallon Company says the project has 2.5 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. Of course, a parking deck under a building has to support a heavier load, and underground parking adds even more cost to the project. The reality is parking is one of the more expensive parts of the equation, Van Cannon says. That's one reason Fallon is taking a fresh look at what it does with its two other planned towers at the site. There are ways to share parking to make it more cost-efficient, Van Cannon says. And under the heading of tourism, the article, Hey, Come Visit Raleigh, Hotels Are Available. As the hospitality industry continues to struggle amid the pandemic, the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau has launched a campaign to boost tourism. Earlier this year, the group, also known as Visit Raleigh, received $1.25 million in CARES Act funds to fund its initiative. Now its Wish You Were Here campaign is intended to lure visitors back to the Raleigh area. Dennis Edwards, president and CEO of Visit Raleigh, says the message is that the market is not only reopened, but safely welcoming visitors once again. Since March, hotels around the region have struggled with low occupancy rates and government restrictions amid the pandemic. Occupancy remains around 40%, far below what most hotels consider sustainable. And under the heading of retail comes the article, Chapel Hill Firm Buys a Stake in Allbirds. Chapel Hill-based Morgan Creek Capital Partners has secured millions for a stake in a buzzy San Francisco shoe company. Morgan Creek has nearly $4 million targeted for a position in wool shoe innovator Allbirds. The fund, dubbed Morgan Creek Private Opportunities, Series G Allbirds, utilized 25 investors, two of whom were not accredited according to the filing. Morgan Creek founder Mark Yesko says the fund is the result of a mix of opportunity and demand. There are a lot of people who wanted to get exposure to this space, and we're fortunate because we came up with some shares of the company that we could make available to investors, he said. Yesko said Morgan Creek typically does about 1 to 2 SPVs a quarter, and that ends up giving us a nice volume of activity that we can manage quite effectively. Allbirds' first show was the Wool Runner, made from New Zealand merino wool. And finally on this week's biz page, comes under the heading of sports business, comes the article, former NBA player takes the plunge into COVID-19 relief. A retired NBA player from Raleigh has a new challenge: keeping COVID-19 out of office spaces, schools, and other areas as the nation tries to reopen. Chris Wilcox, who played at Enloe High School before moving to the University of Maryland and a long pro career, leads Wilcox Distribution in Raleigh. His company has contracted with Integrated Viral Protection to sell and distribute a system that kills airborne COVID-19. I wanted to jump in and grab hold of something that can make a difference in our community, Wilcox says. IVP has a portable device that covers 1,800 cubic feet per minute without heating the ambient air. It also has special filters for HVAC systems, and it says its products can kill 99.999% of airborne SARS-CoV-2, which caused COVID-19. The systems were developed by Manzar Hourani, a Houston-based inventor and entrepreneur, and Dr. Garrett Peel is a founding partner in the firm. We need to figure out a way to make our environments that we live in indoors safe, Peel says, and the only way to do that is to introduce fresh and clean air, and that's hard to do. So far, the IVB systems have been adopted in some Texas hotels, medical facilities, and schools, as well as in a few other states. The deal with Wilcox Distributing is an effort to expand that footprint. We're excited about our partnership with Chris and the team there in North Carolina, Peel says. Wilcox, who played in the NBA from 2002 to 2013, sees an opportunity for all sorts of places to benefit from the systems, including schools. He and his wife, Tiffany, have 3 children, so he's well aware of the challenges of online learning. Getting these kids back in school is a big thing for me, he quips. Now we turn to the inside pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of news, we find the article, $300 million build. Construction is set to begin on a $300 million mixed-use destination in downtown Raleigh, calling for hundreds of apartments, swaths of retail, and more. Hoffman and Associates plans to begin construction on their massive Seaboard Station mixed-use development this fall, with the first phase calling for 7 stories of 300 apartments and 30,000 square feet of retail. The company has yet to finalize a date for the start of work, but says it will begin in the next month or two, with the company expecting a delivery date of Q3 2022 for the first phase. We're excited to honor the legacy of this historic location with a design that will contribute to this vibrant community, making it a destination for downtown Raleigh, surrounding neighborhoods, and the region, says John Florian, Executive Vice President of Development for Hoffman and Associates. Seaboard Station will be an expanded urban neighborhood that seamlessly fits with the existing landscape, featuring unique retailers, local chef-driven restaurants, and entertainment concepts in an engaging community. Across all phases, the project is expected to feature over 600 apartments, 130,000 square feet of retail space, a hotel, outdoor dining and entertainment space, and underground parking. No start date has been announced for the other two phases. Firms involved in the planning and design of Seaboard Station include Streetworks Studio, Raleigh architecture firm Klein Design Associates, and Raleigh landscape architecture and engineering firm Stewart Incorporated. We deeply appreciate Raleigh City staff allowing our design team to create innovative design elements that will contribute to this dynamic community and enhance the north end of downtown Raleigh, Florian says. Florian joined Huffman after decades in Raleigh after a friend from his days in Washington, D.C., Monty Huffman of Huffman & Associates, reached out and said his company was considering expanding into Raleigh. As soon as he talked to me about joining forces in Raleigh, Seaboard Station came to mind, he says. It's a perfect fit for the kind of work Huffman has done. The Seaboard Station project soon after became Huffman's premier project in the Triangle and the site of its first office outside of D.C. In addition to Seaboard Station, the company has also been named the preferred developer on Go Triangle's bus station and tower project and has already begun some design work on the tower. Construction on that project is expected to begin next year. And under the heading of Triangle Universities, pandemic drives demand for innovation. Despite COVID-19 causing worry among many in higher education over valuable revenue streams, research universities in the Triangle say their innovation and commercialization activity has never been higher. We've not seen a downturn in the number of companies and the energy that startup founders are putting into the company, says Judith Cohn, UNC Chapel Hill's Vice Chancellor of Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Economic Development. One of the reasons, she says, is the array of patents and existing research the university has, especially in medicine. Cohn says that early in the pandemic, UNC's Office of Technology Commercialization was inundated with requests from other researchers across the world to have access to our knowledge. For fiscal year 2020, UNC made 170 invention disclosures. It received more than $5.4 million in licensing revenue and received 49 patents from the U.S. government. It also launched three intellectual property-based startups. Duke University reported 405 invention disclosures and $65 million in revenue. It received 98 patents and launched 17 startups in fiscal 2020. At NC State University, Wade Fulton, Assistant Vice Chancellor for the Offices of Research Commercialization and Research and Innovation, says the university's textile expertise has kept innovation flowing. As far as impact, we've been very effective at working remotely, he says. We're busier than ever. For NC State, in fiscal year 2019-2020, data has not been released. The university reports 21 startup companies made 295 invention disclosures and received 75 patents, all record highs for the university. Next on our news page under the heading of bandwidth is the article CEO, Why COVID and WFH Drove $527 Million Buy to Spread Global Reach to 60 Countries. Hours after Bandwidth announced its multi-million-dollar buy of Brussels-based Voxbone, October 12th, an analyst asked, why now? Time has become more valuable than money, answered David Morkin, CEO of the Raleigh-based company focused on communications platform as a service. I think the COVID work from home was the fuse that lit the enterprise race to the cloud rocket, and we can't afford to wait. Bandwidth, which recently announced it was expanding with a new headquarters in Raleigh, plans to close the deal October 31st. Morgan said the deal, once finalized, accelerates Bandwidth's international expansion by several years. The Voxbone buy comes just a year after Bandwidth began serving customers in Europe. Voxbone, a communications platform and IP voice network, counts among its customers Uber, Zoom, and Skype. The company has about 200 employees. Since 2015, it has been majority owned by Vitruvian Partners, a technology-focused investment firm headquartered in London since 2015. With Voxbone, Bandwidth can serve more than 60 countries, about 93% of the global economy, Morgan said. The U.S., where Bandwidth has been focused since its inception, makes up less than half of the total addressable market, he said. Bandwidth had other options, but Morgan said Bandwidth picked Voxbone for one main reason. The people were the driver. While Morgan said the complementary culture, coupled with the technology, were major factors, it was the team itself that differentiated Voxbone from Bandwidth's other options. It became obvious that we were singing from the same sheet of music, he said. The deal also means cross-selling opportunities. Morgan said there is overlap with about 900 Voxbone customers, but our very largest customers are going to enjoy this combination and the value it for the first time. The deal has Bandwidth acquiring the firm for €446 million, which is nearly $527 million. Bandwidth will pay cash in the amount of $400 million, or about €338 million. The remainder of the deal will be paid for in stock. Voxbone reported more than $85 million in revenue for the year. As for Voxbone itself, much of the details of integration are still being worked out, including where the unit will be based. While the firm is based in Belgium, they have a terrific team in London, Morgan said. Bandwidth, which counts as customers Google, Zoom, and Microsoft, embeds voice, messaging, and 911 access into software and applications. And it's planning to create more than 1,000 jobs in Raleigh with a new $100 million headquarters. And on the next page of news in this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of foreclosure auction, comes the article, Iconic Tower in Downtown Durham Sold. A historic tower in downtown Durham changed hands recently after a New York real estate investment giant bought the property following the previous owner's payment default and subsequent foreclosure earlier this year. Turnbridge Equities paid $37.2 million for the tower at Mutual Plaza, formerly the NC Mutual building. The 14-story tower features 180,000 square feet of Class A office space near the American Tobacco campus. We are obviously strong believers in the Triangle's resiliency, said Jason Davis, managing director of Turnbridge. The local economy is uniquely well-positioned to weather any downturns with its mix of governmental, educational, and private employers, including Durham's thriving technology and life sciences sectors. We're excited to bring fresh capital to the tower at Mutual Plaza to reinvigorate the building. Altogether, Turnbridge's purchase includes around 3 acres at 405 and 411 West Chapel Hill Street and 450 Jackson Street. The tower sold through a mortgage foreclosure auction that ended earlier this month. The property's previous owner defaulted on payments late last year, according to county records. The previous owner was an LLC made up of local investors, including company principal Michael Lemansky, according to financial filings. The company bought the property in 2006 for $10.5 million and began an $11 million renovation of the property in 2017. In December, the LLC defaulted on the loan. The balance at the time of foreclosure was $37.2 million. Turnbridge ultimately acquired a subordinate interest in the property's loan and bought the property through the mortgage foreclosure. Knighthead Funding, LLC, provided the debt financing for Turnbridge's acquisition of the tower. Turnbridge is pleased to be the new owners of this iconic and historically significant building, said Ryan Nelson, managing partner of Turnbridge. We are big believers in the Research Triangle as a whole, and I couldn't think of a better first investment in Durham. We're eager to reintroduce the tower at Mutual Plaza to the local market. Turnbridge plans to bring additional capital improvements and seek to add tenants. Currently, the tower is just 60% occupied. The building at 411 West Chapel Hill Street opened in 1966. At the time, it was the city's tallest building and has served as the home to the NC Mutual Life Insurance Company, one of the state's most prominent African-American businesses, for more than 50 years. The building was designed by Welton Beckett and Associates. Beckett designed many iconic buildings on the West Coast. Last year, the Durham City Council gave unanimous approval to make the tower at Mutual Plaza a local historical landmark. The purchase is the latest in the triangle for Turnbridge. Last month, the company and its partner, Denali Properties, announced plans to break ground next year on Carolina Yards, a massive mixed-use project to redevelop Cary Town Center into a new urban hub. Over the summer, Turnbridge announced plans to redevelop the site of the Creamery Building in Raleigh's Glenwood South. The company bought the property earlier this year. We've built upon all of our prior experience and in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Austin, Texas, and try to bring a similar level of quality and execution in the Raleigh-Durham market, said Andrew Jablon, founder and managing principal of Turnbridge. Now, the next page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, also labeled news, has the heading Rising Concern, and the article is UNC to enroll 6,000 for world's largest study of eating disorders. UNC Chapel Hill researchers are looking to enroll more than 6,000 patients in what will end up being the world's largest genetic study of eating disorders. The Eating Disorders Genetics Initiative, known by the acronym EDGI, aims to identify the hundreds of genes that influence a person's risk of developing three different eating disorders: anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. Dr. Cynthia Bulick, a UNC professor in the Department of Psychiatry and a principal investigator of the EDGI, says the goal is to identify a potential future treatment and even therapeutic strategies that could save lives from those with mental illnesses. Bulick said the study will collect saliva samples and questionnaires from anyone over 18 years old that has ever been diagnosed with an eating disorder. UNC's enrollment will coincide with a number of other countries looking to enroll patients in the study, including the UK, Germany, Mexico, the Netherlands, and Taiwan, all of which have secured independent funding for the initiative, as well as a number of others. Bulick says researchers plan to create a global study that will have more than 100,000 participants, a necessary scale because of the complicated nature of the disorders. In order to detect those smallest set of genes, you need to have a large sample of people with illness to compare to large samples of people without the illness. And that gives you the power you need to detect small effect genes, she said. A number of other countries that are participating in the study have already begun enrollment. Bulick says UNC planned to start earlier this year, but was delayed by the pandemic. The necessity of finding additional options, Bulick says, is heightened now. I always say that eating disorders thrive in isolation, she says. Social distancing and being cut off from people is just fertile ground for eating disorders, and even people who are recovered are saying that they're having these relapse urges, and it's super hard for them. Researchers are aiming to have all the samples from the global study collected by 2022, and Bulick says analysis of the results will begin immediately thereafter. Next, we turn to this week's cover story. In essence, this whole issue is a special business report, but the cover issue for today, the cover story for today, is entitled Making Diversity and Inclusion Stick. This year, idle conversations are turning into C-suite commitments. Over the 25 years she's been working in human resources, Gracie Johnson-Lopez says there's always been talk about racial equity in the workplace. But now the conversation and the commitments have escalated to a new level. Topics that were taboo, systemic racism, inherent biases, cultural differences, are gaining traction. For the longest time, organizations and HR professionals, myself included, said, you can't talk about these things at work. You need to check it at the door. Well, business leaders have caught on. You can't check it at the door. You bring your whole self into the workplace, and when that happens, it can become a real distractor in the organization, says Johnson Lopez, founder and president of Diversity and HR Solutions. Since launching her company in 2016, her vision has been to help companies move from talking about issues of race to integrating diversity, equity, and inclusion as foundational elements within the organization. Now the elevation of DEI has become a driving force across business, America's businesses. Not only company stakeholders, but also the communities where they work and play are asking about the demographics of the boardroom and executive leadership, Johnson Lopez says. It's not just about the number of minorities employed. It's their decision-making influence. Increasingly, company leaders are being asked where women and people of color are positioned within the organization. Because of those external demands and pressures, there's more awareness and more appetite to move beyond conversation, she says. What happens in our global society drives and helps dictate what company leaders determine is important. The Black Lives Matter movement and the murder of George Floyd have caused more of a reaction and response than anything I've ever seen. This growing appetite to move from talk to action has led demand for her services. Revenue at her company is running 55% ahead of last year. Her five-person staff from 2019 has grown to 10. She expects to add a couple more people before the end of the year. Leading an organization today requires courage, curiosity, and commit, Johnson Lopez says. We all have implicit biases. Leaders have to identify the inherent biases that are getting in the way of their business strategy. The client mix at Diversity and HR Solutions is roughly 65% corporate, 35% nonprofits and government, including local municipalities and chambers of commerce. But this year, more global companies have come on board. In particular, the biggest growth sector in 2020 has been the bioscience industry, along with healthcare. Regardless of industry, leaders increasingly realize the need to build and support a diverse company culture. If leaders within the workplace do not have the cultural competencies to navigate the necessary conversations, it impacts productivity and employee retention, Johnson Lopez says, noting that the cost of employee turnover is huge. The Society for Human Resource Management reported in 2019 that 1 in 5 Americans had left a job within the preceding 5 years due to a bad company culture. And the cost of that turnover was an estimated $223 billion. If you're leading an organization, you're looking at the dollars as it relates to talent acquisition and what happens in the life cycle of your workforce. You're asking, what are our challenges for recruiting as a diverse workforce? Why are people leaving? It may be ethnicity. It may be gender. Or the big thing we're seeing is age. Millennials have shaken things up and redefined the way we work. They're not talking about work-life balance. They're talking about work-life integration. They care about community and are focused on what's happening with humanity. They're asking hard questions, and they want to know what the company stands for and the real values of the organization. For years, Johnson Lopez says she's conducted listening sessions to help facilitate conversations around race and ethnicity. But in the last few months, demand has escalated, and she has done more than 80 sessions for some 25 organizations. Leaders are saying they want to support and help their Black employees. They want to create a safe space to have real conversations and learn how they can help. The C-suite is focusing on workplace culture much more than I've seen in past years. They're saying, we need to do more. We need to do better. We need to listen, and we need to be part of the solution. She's quick to point out that DEI is not just about race and gender, and there's a range of other differences that business leaders need to be aware of and sensitive to supporting. Neurodiversity, mental health, and disabilities are high on the list, and merit appropriate accommodations, she says. The numbers are increasingly significant in terms of people saying what they need, and barriers are being dismantled, so there's no longer a stigma of shame, Johnson Lopez says. Additionally, she says more work and support is needed for the LGBTQ community, and particularly within global organizations, the conversation around religion and faith requires attention. The language we use now when we talk about a diverse workforce is to say we need to create a sense of belonging so people are where they want to be, and the people they want to work with want them there. For decades, the elephant in the room was race, but now Johnson Lopez says it's equity. The term equity gets married to white privilege, and people shut down when they hear equity because they think it means, in order to bring you up, I've got to go down, she explains. Before an organization can take on the equity conversation, the leaders and workforce have to be adequately trained, educated, and prepared to engage. Otherwise, she cautions, it can backfire, and the people who need to facilitate the equity work will shut down on you. The biggest mistake she fears business leaders might make is allowing the focus on racial equity to fade, to be a temporary response to a systemic, long-term problem. It's important that we do more than a statement on our website, that we continue to look at who makes up our boardrooms and our executive teams, at where we invest our dollars and with whom. And we look at how we are perpetuating the inequalities that exist. If we only have a narrow view for this moment in time, we will find ourselves back here again. And as usual, for frequent listeners of Triangle Business Journal, you will know that after we read the cover story, we read the article entitled Executive Voice. This week's Executive Voice belongs to David Komen, and it's entitled Changing the CRO World. Science 37 was founded in Los Angeles with a specific goal in mind, improving clinical research through technological improvements to the popular model by making the promise of virtual trials the new reality. But making a substantive pivot in the way the entire industry operates was no small task. But then came a catalyst, COVID-19. Overnight, every major clinical research organization in the world found itself desperately in need of finding a way to keep their trials going without physical access. For CEO David Komen, the opportunity and need could not be any more abundant for Science 37. He was named CEO in November, officially establishing the Triangle as the dual headquarters location of the remote contract research organization. In fact, due to COVID-19, the company has had to forego its plans to grab real estate in the area, but though its physical presence has yet to come, the company is booming with new business both in the region and out. So here's the Q&A for David Komen. How has 2020 been for the company? While it's been a tragic year for the country and the world, we were fortunate enough to be in the position to have great effect on some of the change that needs to happen in order to accommodate it. So we've been fortunate to have significant business growth over the course of this year. Outside of the obvious need now, why focus on virtual trials? The first clinical visit I ever made was to a site in New Bern, where I met a white man and his wife who were trying to get enrolled in a clinical study. This poor man traveled from Fayetteville in order to get there. So it was 2 hours and 15 minutes to get there, and he spent 15 to 30 minutes maybe in the waiting room, and then he had to drive another 2 hours and some change back. I came to find out in the process that he was going to have to do that on a monthly basis, and the person was a 40-year-old man with Parkinson's disease. So if you think about the current purely site-based model, it really excludes patients from participation. So there's a real opportunity for us collectively, not just Science 37, to democratize clinical research and bring it to anybody, anywhere. So will the industry keep using this model after COVID-19? Everybody in the industry talks about risk for the compound, risk for the success of the trial. The reality is the traditional site-based model does pose a significant amount of risk. So whether we're in an endemic environment or not, this is an alternative channel that can be utilized to mitigate a lot of that risk. When is the next pandemic? Who knows? But even notwithstanding that, we're also proving models to be more efficient, and our ability to recruit patients is faster. Are you trying to become a global CRO or stop in some middle ground? Why would I stop in a middle ground? We absolutely see Science 37 as a very large organization into the future. The more we can prove the capabilities we implement are more efficient, the more utility that's going to build for our customers, and the more business we're going to attract. We'll continue to be the edge of that, drive our customer success, and ours and others will follow. Why does Science 37 believe it can implement this model and challenge global CROs? Our model is purpose-built to make this happen. We don't have the distraction of decades worth of infrastructure put in place to stand up sites and to manage sites. I always talk about the lens through which I look at the industry, which is through the lens of the customer. And if you're asking the question of how to enroll patients into clinical research, you have to do so through the lens of the patient. But the traditional CRO model has always had the lens at the site. It's always been a very site-first driven culture. Why did you choose the name Science 37? Body temperature in Celsius is 37 degrees. We use science to get you back to 37. What motivates you? I was an advertising major and then went into the telecom industry. And I used to think to myself, what am I doing with my life? I'm selling cigarette lighter adapters and cell phones, and couldn't I do something more meaningful in my life? So I made a massive career change when I was already an executive to get into pharma and then subsequently into the clinical research industry, because the work we do is the work worth doing. I wake up every single day feeling like I'm making a bigger difference to the planet. I hope that doesn't sound too cheesy, but it's the truth. Finally, the question, any advice for others who feel that way? Answer, make it happen. I don't mean that to be flippant, but if you really want something, you have to actually make it happen. It's not going to happen itself. You have to have intentional focus. You need to know where you want to go. Second is to break the barriers that are in your way. Every time you want to make a change, there are going to be barriers. You can't let barriers get in your way. You have to go break through them. Will them away through action, and then make it happen. Make a difference and be accountable to what those goals are and drive toward them working. I mentioned once before that this week's Triangle Business Journal is a special business report focusing on equity and diversity. A few minutes ago, I read the article about Gracie Johnson Lopez, and now here comes an equivalent article entitled One System, Unequal Access? The annual number of Small Business Administration loans to black businesses decreased 84% since peaking before the 2008 financial crisis, according to an examination by the Business Journals of lending data for the agency's flagship 7A program. The decrease came despite 48% growth in the economy, a 101% increase in bank deposits, and an 82% jump in commercial loans. The decline also corresponded with a 53% decline in all 7A loans awarded. Access to capital for black businesses appears to have worsened since compounding the economic fallout from COVID-19. A Stanford University study of the pandemic's effects found 41% of black businesses ceased operations as of April, compared with 17% of white businesses. Relief measures have lagged. A review by the New York Times of a key COVID relief program, that's the Federal Paycheck Protection Program, showed 75% of the government's initial round of emergency loans went to businesses in majority white census tracts. Tracking small business lending by race is difficult. Banks are prohibited from collecting data on the race and ethnicity of borrowers. Critics say that's the first thing that needs to change. To determine whether a decline in lending to black-owned businesses goes beyond the SBA's 7(a) program, which accounts for roughly 7% of all small business loans, the Business Journal's interviewed black business owners in most of the nation's 44 markets. It also conducted a demographic analysis of small business lending using census tracts. The reporting shows significant lending disparities. For example, the Business Journal found white neighborhoods receive roughly twice as much per person in small business loans compared with black neighborhoods. Likewise, majority white neighborhoods on average receive roughly twice as much small business loans per capita. Economic experts say the trends exacerbate racial disparities in wealth generation, home ownership rates, educational attainment, and other vital rungs on the American dream's financial ladder. I don't think most Americans understand the severity of the problem, said Orv Kimbrough, CEO of Midwest Bank Center, a community bank in St. Louis. I call it corporate redlining. Among the findings from the Business Journal's analysis, here there are three. First, the country's four biggest banks, which hold roughly 35% of the nation's deposits, made 91% fewer 7(a) loans to black-owned businesses in 2019 than in 2007. Citibank made 72 in 2019. Bank of America made 252. J.P. Morgan Chase made 1,852. And Wells Fargo made 3,109. By comparison, those same banks originated at least 5,285 7(a) loans to all businesses during the SBA's fiscal 2019. The third finding, majority black census tracts with more than 500 people averaged $157 in small business loans per person in 2018. Majority white census tracts averaged $302. Banks say creditworthy borrowers can get loans and cited numerous new and existing programs as proof of their commitment to fund black businesses. They also say that comparing SBA 7(a) loan volumes to 2007 is cherry-picking because that year marks the height of reckless lending on Wall Street. Critics say those responses miss the point. Banks benefit from deposit insurance and cheap government loans. Many survived the 2008 financial crisis with taxpayer-funded bailouts. In return, they say banks are obligated to serve the entire community. They also note the economy expands when it becomes more inclusive. A recent study by economists at Stanford and the University of Chicago shows as much as 40% of U.S. gross domestic product growth between 1960 and 2010 resulted from improved equality in the workplace. We generate more economic activity when there is not discrimination, said Rukia Adams, chief investment officer for Oregon's Meyer Memorial Trust, which is generating outsized returns by inclusively investing its $800 million endowment. Banks are not following the social contract or the empirical evidence. Instead, they're reinforcing old systems of capital distribution and power. They need to step up. Paula Hayes felt confident in seeking a $275,000 loan for her company, Hugh Noor. Founded in 2009, the Portland, Oregon company makes cosmetics for women of color. Hugh Noor had a loyal following, built over years of selling foundation, lipstick, eyeshadow, and other products at trade shows and makeup parties. She and her husband, both black, said at the time they had strong credit scores, owned a home, and had assets they were willing to use as collateral. We checked off all the boxes, said Hayes, who previously worked as a product development chemist, and yet I still felt like it wasn't enough. It wasn't. Hayes was turned down by three banks, including a large regional bank where she had a business account. The rejection she heard most often was that the bank didn't lend to consumer product companies. I felt like my husband and I had the resources, we have the pedigree, for it to be so hard for us. I wonder how hard it is for other people who aren't in the same position we are in, she said. Hayes needed a loan for equipment and working capital for larger manufacturing runs. None of the banks would do both. Hayes said bankers suggested she turn to family and friends for capital, a common avenue for entrepreneurs, but one that's not as available to many black business owners. Black household wealth in America is roughly one-tenth of white household wealth. The black home ownership rate is roughly 30 percentage points lower than the white home ownership rate. Recent research shows the worst outcomes for black borrowers aren't simply explained away by less collateral. A July SBA Office of Advocacy study, which used Federal Reserve data and adjusted for credit risk, showed black-owned businesses face the biggest challenges in obtaining their desired financing. The study cited 9 academic papers reaching the same basic conclusion. Black founders, including Hayes, often rely on a patchwork of alternatives for financing from microlenders, nonprofits, or private capital funds focused on people of color. Those resources are limited and usually invest smaller amounts of capital than commercial loans. That can stifle growth. Our journey has been a lot slower than I would have initially anticipated, Hayes said. In 2014, a year and 3 denials after her search commenced, Hayes landed a $150,000 equipment loan from Portland-based Albina Community Bank, now part of Beneficial State Bank, based in Oakland, California. For working capital, she and her husband tapped savings and invested 6 figures in the company. 3 years ago, Hayes got a $25,000 loan from Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon, a Portland-based organization that lends to women and minority entrepreneurs. The money allowed her to attend a trade show in New York, where she landed Target as a customer. That led to an additional $50,000 in venture capital from Elevate Capital in Portland. Hugh Noir, which employs 4, is now sold in Costco, Sally Beauty, and about 10 national boutiques, as well as online. Her loan from Albina has been paid back, and she said her loan from MESO will be paid off in months. The SBA's 7A program, which guarantees as much as 90% of loans made by banks, doled out $23.2 billion in 2019, including $755 million to black-owned businesses. The program's guarantee is designed to make small business loans more palatable to banks, which often balk at companies that lack significant collateral. Black businesses got 3% of 7A loan dollars in 2019. The SBA declined requests by the business journals to provide historical percentage of loan dollars that went to black businesses. The Wall Street Journal previously reported 8% of SBA loan dollars in 2008 went to black businesses. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, about 9.5% of U.S. businesses are black-owned. The rationale and the reason for government involvement in any lending market is to produce a better outcome for those who are not able to access credit, said Jesse Van Tol, CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, an organization that works to build wealth in underserved communities. Look at the history of SBA programs. They're set up to serve women and minorities. The SBA does have an obligation to address these kinds of disparities. In 2014, the National Association of Government Guaranteed Lenders commissioned a study of the decrease in SBA loans to black businesses. American University researchers Derek Hira and Megan Dowdy concluded several factors caused the collapse, including the impact of predatory lending on black homeowners, smaller loan sizes sought by black businesses when banks were increasingly lending larger amounts, and a decline in loans in low-income neighborhoods. Hira and Dowdy made several recommendations, including reducing borrowing fees and increasing guarantees. Hira said the recommendations haven't been adopted. We had one meeting at the Obama White House, Hira said. I didn't see any of the recommendations that we made take hold within the SBA. I don't think things have changed much. The SBA did not respond to written questions about HIRA's findings. The SBA is the only public source for small business loan data organized by race and gender. To determine whether SBA 7A lending data is indicative of larger trends, the Business Journal worked with Portland State University to analyze small business loan data collected through the Community Reinvestment Act. Passed in 1977, the CRA requires banks to disclose information about small business loans. The data does not provide information about the race of borrowers, but it identifies the census tract where each loan is made. The analysis showed small businesses in majority black census tracts have significantly less access to bank loans than businesses in majority white tracts. Small business lending also falls as the percentage of black residents increases. The 1,950 U.S. census tracts with at least 90% black populations got $95 in small business loans per person in 2018, compared with $234 in census tracts of at least 90% white populations, or roughly $2.43 in white tracts for every $1 in black tracts. In census tracts with a simple majority of white or black residents, banks originated $1.93 in white tracts for every $1 in black tracts. It suggests that people are more willing to invest in white neighborhoods and white people. Capital markets are just harsher on black communities, said Andre Perry, a fellow at the Brookings Institution who studies wealth creation and race. When you don't invest, you get social problems. You get crime, less education, all of which reduces the chances of people climbing the social and economic ladder. Wells Fargo, Chase, Bank of America, and Citibank, sometimes referred to as the Big Four because of their dominant market share, declined to make executives available for on-the-record interviews or provide details on SBA loan amounts to black businesses since the 2008-09 recession. Similarly, the SBA declined to answer questions or agree to an interview. The agency has not responded to a recent Freedom of Information Act request seeking loan data, including dollar amounts and default rates, for black-owned businesses since 2007. The major banks appear to be aware of the lending disparities. After a 2015 Gallup study of its support for minority-owned businesses, Wells Fargo launched a $75 million program that supported community organizations that lend to disadvantaged businesses. This year, the San Francisco Bank announced a $17.4 million commitment to similar community organizations. The bank also said it's intensifying our commitment to diverse businesses and enabling more than $1 billion in support. Through these programs, we're working with an extensive ecosystem of partner organizations to identify additional ways we can help create greater access to capital, technical support and guidance, credit coaching, and philanthropic aid, the bank said. Last, we turn to the viewpoint page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And since there are several very long articles in this issue, the only article that I'll have time for is the editor's notebook. While reading the final pages of this week's print issue that focuses on the celebration challenges and the dwindling options for minority businesses, an alert popped up on my phone about two financial giants, BlackRock and J.P. Morgan Chase, announcing their third quarter earnings. BlackRock, the world's largest money manager, reported profits rose 22% during the quarter to $1.36 billion on revenue of $4.37 billion. That also rose some 18%. Not to be outdone, J.P. Morgan followed by announcing that the banking giant's profits during third quarter topped $9.4 billion, higher than the same quarter last year. Chances are many of the financial companies reporting their financials while you read this piece likely will post strong numbers in the next few days. These developments are good for the economy, as the strength in our financial markets often instills confidence in the future. But the problem is that wealth and profit creation still is not flowing smoothly downstream, leaving thousands of small businesses with fewer doors to open to grow their business. And that's especially true for minority business. As our story this week points out, consider the following two options. One, The country's four biggest banks, which hold roughly 35% of the nation's deposit, made 91% fewer 7A loans to black-owned businesses in 2019 than in 2007. Citibank made 748 in 2019, Bank of America 323, J.P. Morgan Chase 1,891, Wells Fargo 3,150. The U.S. Small Business Administration's 7A program is designed to help the nation's minority businesses with loans. Typically, the government guarantees about 90% of the loan amount. Second major point, majority black census tracts with more than 500 people averaged $157 in small business loans per person in 2018. Majority white census tracts averaged $302. We can talk about numbers all day, but that will not change the ominous trend unless, of course, our government leaders work with the nation's largest lending institutions and carving out a 10- or 20-year plan to improve the money flow and narrow the economic inequality curve. The winners of the Leaders in Diversity Awards, mentioned elsewhere in this week's Triangle Business Journal, understand that trends are unsustainable for a functioning society. If you let the divide between the haves and have-nots get wider, there will be a revolution in the end, an economic uprising that likely will dent and injure most of the assets we've built in the last 250-plus years. Just days ago, J.P. Morgan said it's committing a total of $30 billion over 5 years to the effort, which focuses heavily on expanding access to affordable housing, as well as boosting minority-owned small businesses. And last month, Bank of America invested $50 million in three black-owned banks as part of its $1 billion pledge over 4 years to advance racial equality. There's progress, but we need to escalate our desire to intentionally help small businesses. Not only will it spread the economic prosperity across a larger section of the population, it's the right thing to do. That music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. For questions or comments, call us 919-832-5138. So long.